Hello and welcome to the Harvard Press Podcast. My name is Chris Gondek, and today I'll be speaking with John S. Allen about his new book, The Omnivorous Mind, Our Evolving Relationship with Food. John Allen is research scientist at Dornsife Cognitive Neuroscience Imaging Center and the Brain Creativity Institute at the University of Southern California. John Allen, thanks so much for being on the Harvard Press Podcast today.
Yeah, great to be here.
You know, everyone listening to this show has some foods they like and some foods they avoid. Sometimes this is due to how we like the taste, and sometimes it's because certain behavioral norms we seek to embody. Are there other forces at play in our food preferences that are under the radar of our conscious minds?
Well, when you think about your food preferences and what you like and you don't like, it's good to consider that as you're sitting there, that you're today the product of multiple histories. And some of these histories have to do with your own personal growing up, but some of it have to do with our cultural history or your biological history, your evolutionary history. So it's quite clear that as a human being, that you have a fairly strong preference already sort of built in for sweet or salty or even fat or high-density foods that we've evolved because we're primates or we're mammals, and those preferences are always operating. And then going in a more sort of closer, more in our own neighborhood is how you grew up, your family, in your developmental environment also shapes how you eat. And then finally also going even a sort of broader is your cultural environment and how your culture sort of shapes those preferences and aversions or dislikes. I shouldn't say aversions because that's a somewhat different aspect of what we do and don't want to eat. How your culture shapes the possibilities of what you eat or the things that you see as being either acceptable or not acceptable, even though they're perfectly edible from that other history, from that primate history. So there are all sorts of these things are operating sort of below the radar, some of which we're aware of sometimes you're not aware of them. But they all go into making an individual's sort of palate.
We're recording this on the Monday after probably the biggest food holiday here in the United States, Thanksgiving. And you spend quite a bit of time in your book talking about Thanksgiving and what it means. It seems that Thanksgiving is probably the most popular American-based holiday, not only here, but I mean, I know a lot of people around the world that celebrate it, even if they're not America. What is it about Thanksgiving and food, I guess, beyond just the average taste that strikes such a chord with people?
Well, I think Thanksgiving is a memory feast. And in that sense, that it's a, you know, in a very conscious sense, it was designed to be that. It was designed to honor this history of America, this certain version of the history of America, of the Pilgrims and the cooperation with Native Americans, a history that isn't really borne out by the actual history ultimately, but nonetheless, it was developed to reinforce memory. So in that sense, it goes back to that sort of memory aspect of our history. It brings out the history. And it's all there on the table. You know, each food item potentially, or in its original sense, was supposed to be evocative of something in the past. But then even more than that, in terms of personal or family histories, it becomes this sort of a touchstone for the passage of time for years. And you can think about what we do as a family and how we reinforce certain relationships within the family. And you can think about the noting of the passage of time when I was at the little kids' table and then I was at the big kids' table and then I was at the old people's table. I don't know if people have old people's tables. But all that sort of serves to make this a memory feast, Thanksgiving. And, you know, there's all sorts of other dimension. I mean, even the layout, it's a different sort of spatial environment in which we, you know, we get a big table or we get a little table or we travel to go to a certain place. It's all these things sort of all go into American history and cultural history and personal histories that really serve to heighten its power.
When I was growing up, of course, still today, everybody likes to have turkey on Thanksgiving. But a recent thing that's happened is coming from the South is you can now find deep fried turkeys. You spent a chapter talking about the whole concept of crispiness. What was it about the whole idea of crispiness that you thought was important enough to start your book with it?
Well, it's almost something that reading something about crispiness almost inspired me to think about these things more deeply. And it was what I read was it was a from a cookbook by Mario Batali, who's, of course, a very celebrated chef. And he had a little quote at the beginning of a recipe, I think it was for a fish, where he said, oh, nothing moves food in a restaurant like putting crispy on the menu. And he goes on to say that there's an innate appeal of crispiness or crispy. And I thought about that, you know, and to an anthropologist and a neuroscientist, which is what I sort of am, you know, those are innate is a loaded word. And you think about it, and you start thinking about, well, you know, when Kentucky Fried Chicken added a new kind of chicken to their menu, they didn't call it crispy. They had to call it extra crispy, because to imply that the original was not crispy would have been sort of devastating. And then I thought, well, yeah, that's true. And then also we see that things that are crispy foods are very adept at crossing boundaries, cultural boundaries. And when you see that, that starts to make you think, well, why if it's so easy to cross cultural boundaries? An example of this goes back to Kentucky Fried Chicken's. I had a colleague, a social anthropologist, who worked in Samoa. And when she would fly in the evening plane from New Zealand, where the connection was, she said the whole plane smelled like Kentucky Fried Chicken, because all the relatives, that was the last stop on the way to the plane. Everyone said, bring back Kentucky Fried Chicken, because you could get it in New Zealand, but not in Samoa. Another example of the ease with which crispy transfers across cultural boundaries is in Japanese cooking. You know, and Japanese culture was famously insular until the 19th century, deliberately isolating themselves from outside influence, although that changed considerably. But many of the things we think of as traditional Japanese food, and some of the most popular items, of course, in other cultures, are the crispy items. And that's like tempura, which is clearly derived from Portuguese or Spanish influences in the 15th and 16th centuries, or 16th centuries, or tonkatsu, which is basically a Japanese version of the Wiener Schnitzel, a breaded, fried, deep-fried meat. And so, you know, all that sort of said, well, maybe there is something to this idea about innate. But then where would something like that come from? And so then you think, well, what are the actual sources of crispy food in nature, right? If we can't deep fry it, which is the way we get a lot of our crispy today, deep frying hasn't been around that long. So where would this innate preference come from? And if you look around in nature, one of the things that's always pretty crispy are bugs. And we think, well, we don't really like bugs that much, at least certainly in Western cuisines. But bugs, if we look back again at our primate heritage, especially very early on, it's very likely that bug eating was quite important in differentiating primates from other kind of mammals, say 60 million years ago. And there are still bug-eating primates, a lot of the littler ones, around. So maybe bugs, maybe there's some very deep preference there, but deep preferences are always sort of controversial to people, to some social scientists especially. Another area, what source of crispy foods are vegetation, vegetables, you know, stalks and certain leaves, and those aren't very appealing to humans in general, but some primates do eat those quite a bit. But I think actually when you think of bugs and vegetation that are crispy, there's an idea there's a concept called fallback foods. And so it's the idea that, oh, you have, you know, some animal may have its preferred food, and that's what they'll eat. But when the things get tough, they'll go eat these things. These are the fallback foods. And we sort of see, oh, bugs and vegetation, vegetables like that, aren't our first choice. Our first choice would be towards more fruits and meats, at least based on our closest relatives, chimpanzees. But we can go back and we can eat these other things too.
It's almost it's an adaptive response that perhaps we've grown over time to know, if we can't get this, if we eat something crispy, at least we know that's something that'll get us through the...
Exactly. So it doesn't have sweet to prefer, isn't fatty or whatever, but at least it's crispy. And so, you know, animals that said, oh, I like crispy too, even if it isn't that tasty it doesn't feel that great when I eat it, I like it because it's crispy. But then with cooking... And Richard Wrangham, a primatologist, has argued that cooking goes back potentially over 1.5 million years, so long before there are people like us. There are apes walking around on two legs, but they're not quite like us. Cooking actually introduces a whole new source of crispy. And that's with cooking, you get these Maillard reactions, which cause the browning reactions, and you get a crispy crust on meat, or crispy vegetable tubers, for example. So that introduces another realm of crispy that predates even our origins, but which other animals wouldn't have because they don't cook.
That degree of culinary sophistication that we find, and it's going to sound a little odd, you know, that humans perhaps have over apes, although you do mention that there's certainly apes who use tools and use some rudimentary things. Does this get to, I guess, one of the bigger issues of your book, that beyond just this issue of taste in food and memory in food, that there are some specific cognitive skills and developments that go along with food that are not innate within the food themselves, but are things that we as humans put onto the food that makes them deeper than just a way of subsistence?
Well, we embed everything we do in culture, and we embed it in a transmissible kind of intelligence. So that we have all these associations. It isn't just memory, but how we organize the whole world is it's both a necessary thing for us to do, but then food slots into that as well. And so from a technological stance, from a linguistic or categorical stance, how we define things, we can't escape, food cannot escape that sort of slot. And so we may have in some, there's always a balance in what I was trying to get at here, is that on one hand, we see biases in our brain towards certain aspects of food and diet. And I think these really do exist. For example, although I don't think they're particularly well understood yet, getting back to memory, the hippocampus is one of the basic, the most fun, you know, the most basic structure, important structure for memory formation and recall. And it has lots of receptors for hormones that we often think of digestive hormones like insulin or others called leptin or ghrelin. And so already, you can see how that could be important memory relating to where food sources are and what you eat. But we get beyond that, then it becomes a more general issue that the idea that we have declarative memories, how we talk about things, well, that's a unique and a much higher level thing. So when we look at technology and when we think about what's fundamental to living is survival and reproduction and eating, food's right in there. And with culture, we naturally make it more complicated.
Is there a similarity between food and how we develop languages?
I think there is. When we talk about language, especially first language, we're not explicitly taught it, and we don't feel like we're learning it. We acquire it in a developmental course. Right. We can linguists and developmental linguists, they could say, oh, I had a 2-year-old, plus or minus X months. And parents, I have those books, about the first 12 months of the first 2 years. And you say, oh, well, are they babbling? Are they making one syllable words? Can they talk? And people compare all this thing. We all know that there's variation around that, but there's a fairly regular course which children acquire language. And then we look at the brain. We know that there are certain areas, certain networks, more importantly, of the brain that are devoted to language. On the other hand, it's the cultural environment that dictates the language that you actually learn. And they can be quite variable. One language, obviously, to another are very variable. And so we have a true sort of biocultural phenomenon there. Then I would argue that, and I've called this something I call a theory of food, that it's an implicit theory of food in your brain, that you're acquiring something like that as you're growing up as well. That is, you're introduced to certain foods. What those foods are will be culturally dictated or familially dictated in certain cases. But I think that's a very universal sort of natural way that children develop a theory of food about how they look at the edible world. And, developmental psychologists have found that children do also go through stages in terms of their exploration of food, how they will eat anything, and then they withdraw and eat fewer things and so on. So that when you grow up, your theory of food is very much like your first language. It's what you eat. And you don't necessarily think about it that hard or even aren't necessarily aware of it unless you're unless it, you come into a situation where you're contrasting it to what someone else eats or what some other culture eats, or, as most of us have learned, the worst of all is when you're trying to actually change your eat to go on a diet or to eat less, or maybe you change your diet because you had a spiritual awakening or you have a different way of looking at the whole world. That's, I call these diets of enlightenment. So like veganism or vegetarianism are the most common ones, but there would be plenty of these that then you're actually giving name to the way you're eating, and you're explicitly putting aside that first theory of food, at least you're trying to. So in that sense, you know, learning a new diet is sort of like learning a new language. It's not impossible. People learn new languages all the time. They learn new diets all the time. But it isn't easy. And it's not nearly as easy as it was when you were age 0 to 3.
Yeah, I guess the farther corollary, it's even if you learn a new language, it's still probably hard, and unless you're immersed in it, not to think in your own language, even if you can speak the other one. And maybe that goes back to the whole idea about how hard it is to stay on a diet.
Exactly. And the thing about a diet is, at least when you learn a second language, you don't have to forget your first language. you can go back to it. When you go on a diet, you got to stop. You can dream or you can imagine you're eating other foods, but you actually have to stop doing it.
John Allen, the author of The Omnivorous Mind, Our Evolving Relationship with Food. Thanks so much for being on the Harvard Press podcast today.
Thanks for having me.
For more information about this title, please visit our website at www.hup.harvard.edu. Don't forget you can follow the press on Facebook, www.facebook.com/HarvardPress. And you can follow us on Twitter, where we are at Harvard_Press. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Harvard Press podcast. Copyright 2011, the President and Fellows of Harvard College, all rights reserved.